Welcome to MRII's Insights and Innovators podcast, where we talk to top market research professionals to get their inside stories about innovative and enduring best practices. Today's episode is sponsored by Question Pro. Question Pro is the web-based software for creating and distributing surveys. With our intuitive wizard interface, digital distribution of surveys, and tools for analyzing and viewing results, Question Pro delivers answers in real time. Now, here's your host for today's episode.
Welcome to today's episode, the OG of customer lifetime value on what really drives business impact, a conversation with Wharton's Pete Fader. I'm your host and former MRII president, John Last. Our guest, Pete Fader, a true pioneer in the field and, dare we say, the OG of customer lifetime value analytics, as the Francis and Pei Wan Shi Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School, Pete has transformed how companies think about customer centricity, predictive analysis, and what it really takes to turn data into decisions. He's also a successful entrepreneur, co-founding Zodiac, acquired by Nike, and now leading Theta Equity Partners, bringing his academic ideas to life in the boardroom. We talk with Pete about the power of behavioral data, how to separate interesting from impactful insights, and the skills today's professionals need to thrive in a rapidly changing analytics landscape. At 2017 Ad Age, Pete was named one of its inaugural 25 top marketing technology trailblazers and the only academic on that list. And whether you're an executive, a student, or somewhere in between, this conversation is packed with sharp insights and big ideas that you won't want to miss. And I can speak firsthand on this knowledge because Pete was actually my professor back when I was at Wharton, when, you know, both of us were about 15 years old, talking about marketing and analytics, and the impact was very impactful for me as well as for other students who took the marketing research curriculum. Pete, welcome to Insights and Innovators, and let's start at the top. Your work has transformed how we think about customer lifetime value and customer centricity. What first drew you to this area of research, and why does it remain so important today?
It's not just that it remains so important, it's getting more and more important. Because way back when you were in my class, taking that old school market research course, the idea of having the kinds of behavioral data, knowing who bought what or who did what when, it was kind of unimaginable. Back then, it really was all about attitudinal questions. So what do you want? What do you think? What would you like? So much of our quantitative curriculum was just more around what people are saying as opposed to what they're doing. But with the advent of, the internet and just all kinds of other kind of tracking technologies, the ability to know who's buying what when and who's doing what when and with whom has just greatly improved. My mentor, back when I was a PhD student at MIT, a woman named Lee McAllister, she said, this is early 1980s, she's saying, we are building the electron microscope of the customer. Pretty soon, we'll be able to tag and track and predict and make better decisions. And I thought she was a bit of a nutcase, but she was really visionary. And here we are. It's just amazing data that are just kind of begging for these more behavioral models. And I've just been riding that wave and having a real good time doing so.
No, it's great. And I know it had an influence on me. We actually at our company meld a lot of behavioral data with attitudinal data in the sports and casino industry in particular, where there's an awful lot of great data. You've written about the difference between being customer centric and product centric, something that I guess I've also kind of grasped onto in my career. Can you unpack what true customer centricity looks like and what organizations still tend to get it wrong?
Yes, and part of it is my fault, because those words, customer centricity, they're kind of vague, and they can really mean different things to different people. So whenever I talk to executives, they'll say, "Oh yeah, we're customer centric. We can't sleep at night until at least happy customers satisfied. The customer is job one." I'll say all this kind of nice sounding stuff, but I don't really believe that. So one of the great things about all this rich behavioral data is we could start to see the differences across our customers. We can celebrate heterogeneity. We can say, what makes the really good customers different? And I'm not just saying because they buy more and they stay longer and they recommend us, but what makes them different in terms of how they talk about us, which products do they use, how did we acquire them in the first place? That's what customer centricity is all about, is to understand which customers we want to be centered around, which customers will propel us to profitable growth for years to come, and which are the ones that, yeah, sure, we're happy to sell to you, but don't expect the special treatment. Today, we have the data to help us tell the differences. We have the opportunity to leverage those differences. We have the competitive imperative to use those differences to distinguish us from our competitors. So there's a host of different reasons why it not only becomes feasible, but essential for companies to lean into the differences across the customer base and let those differences drive the decisions that they make, drive the accountability, the ROI on those decisions, and to have the customer differences drive product development and other kinds of tactics as opposed to the other way around.
And obviously, behavioral data plays such a role in not only understanding those behaviors, but forecasting the actions that customers take. I'm curious, as we've gotten better at it, how central is predictive analytics to the companies you advise? And does it kind of relegate traditional research methods to be a little bit less relevant, or do they complement each other?
So two great questions. So I'd say that these predictive models, these forward-looking understanding of customer behavior, whether it's B2B or B2C, product or service, big company, small company, again, absolutely essential. Just being able to anticipate what they're going to look like in the future, individually and collectively, and start, skating to where the hockey puck is going as opposed to where it is, to use that old Wayne Gretzky quote. Yeah, I wonder if he actually said that. But that is essential, is understanding that our customers, both at an individual level and a kind of a cohort level, are dynamic. But what's amazing is just how predictive that behavior is. Everyone says, oh, our customers are different, or oh, we're constantly being disrupted. But when you just step back and look at that behavioral data, it's just remarkable, if you build the right models, just how accurate they can be and how diagnostic and how actionable. So it's just great stuff. And it doesn't push traditional market research to the back seat at all. It just gives it a different kind of role. Because like I said before, I want to understand what makes those good customers different. And that's where the market research comes in. So instead of just doing these broad surveys and saying, what features, what capabilities are just most broadly popular for our customers, we're going to ask the same kind of question in a narrower way. So which features, which capabilities are the ones that distinguish our high-value customers from our so-so ones? So we can be more tailored, more precise in the kinds of questions that we ask and to whom we ask them. But layering on those why questions on top of the who, what, when questions, it's still essential. And all the behavioral data in the world can answer those questions for you.
Yeah, and I find sometimes when, in our work, when you marry those behaviors with certain attitudes, it can certainly lead to copy and other ways of communicating effectively with them. And it kind of speaks to how you take insights that are interesting and make them actionable. Any advice you
Exactly.
might have on that in terms of bridging that gap between, what's merely good to know versus what's really impactful from a business standpoint?
So a great example of this would be Net Promoter Score. So, and I have great admiration for it, unlike most academics. I think that NPS really did move the needle. Not to say it's the only way to assess customer satisfaction and so on, but it really did get the attention of C-level people, unlike any other kind of marketing metric ever did before it. But at the same time, it is kind of a nice-to-know metric when you take it by itself. Would you recommend us or not? To be able to go that next step to say, okay, that's great, but how often will you recommend us, and to whom will you recommend us, and how much more valuable are you as a customer than you were before? To be able to take the kind of the spirit of Net Promoter Score again, or other survey-oriented methodologies, and augment them with actual dollar and cents outcomes. It gives us this 1 + 1 = 3 kind of synergy and can help us put a real ROI dollar value on a lot of that those research activities that we're doing. So it's not just that, you know, the customers are happier, but they're more valuable. That happiness is showing up as revenue, cash flow, EBITDA, to be able to bridge that gap, to understand what is just cheap talk and what is kind of a forward-looking indication of just a healthier business. That's terrific, and I love being part of that.
And you alluded to it a couple of minutes ago, and certainly I've seen it in my career. There's some companies that get it, that really are able to take things like customer lifetime value and behavioral data and truly integrate them into decision-making versus those who struggle. In your work, are there any characteristics of those organizations that are better able to weave it all together?
You know, what's interesting. I'm going to give you a specific answer. I'm not going to dance around it. But what's interesting is it's hard to find broad characteristics. I mean, one obvious one would be you have to be a company where you can easily tag and track customers. You know who's buying what when, and you have both the technical abilities and even the kind of, you know, legal and ethical ability to then leverage that data. But there's a lot of companies that can do that. Many, many, many companies that can, but don't. And so the ones who, for whatever reason, have really broken out of the pack, there's a couple of sectors where we'll see a lot of it. Gaming, for instance, whether we're talking about a company like Electronic Arts that's developing the games, or a lot of, say, the casinos or the online betting firms, they're like just way better than most of them. Not to say they're all terrific. There's still differences there. Again, related to that would be hospitality. So hotel chains tend to be a little bit better. If we look at retailers, those that are kind of digitally native will just take more, will take to this stuff like ducks to water much more than the folks who were kind of born and raised and maybe still primarily in brick and mortar. So we will see some firms that just lean into it more than others, but there's so many who either surprise me that they're so into it because they're not in sectors where I'd expect it. Company like Allergan Aesthetics, the company that makes Botox and cool sculpting, they're phenomenal at this kind of stuff, even though you wouldn't expect a kind of a pharmaceutical type firm to do so. Whereas there's plenty of others that have all the rich data at their fingertips and are not really taking advantage of it.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Some of the sectors you mentioned are ones that we've seen it and I've kind of held up as best practices as well. It kind of, you know, it's an interesting arc that you've traveled, you know, in the days, you know, since we worked together very closely, or I worked hard for you. You co-founded Zodiac, which Nike acquired, and you lead Theta Equity Partners. So you've got that practical side of building businesses around your academic work. And I'm interested, you know, being able to bridge that gap. How has that shaped your perspective on the way insights are valued in the C-suite today?
Oh boy, have I learned so much. I've learned on so many levels how to run a business, understanding which parts of the academic work really are commercially relevant and appealing, and which parts are, wow, these models are awesome, but we don't know what to do with them. So it's been just an incredible education for me. And while, you know, my day job is still the professor thing, I'm teaching as much, if not more than ever, I'm less interested in writing articles for the academic journals just for the sake of doing so. You know, still do some of that. But I'm more interested in really understanding what kind of R&D do we need to just help companies get smarter about this stuff. And a big part of it is understanding how to broaden the appeal of the model so they're not just a marketing thing. You've mentioned Theta a couple of times now. One of the things that distinguishes it is we're using these same marketing-oriented customer behavior models, but not just to figure out which email to send to which customer at which time, but for corporate valuation, working with lots of private equity firms and investment banks to say, what is that digitally native men's underwear company actually worth? Mm-hmm. And so we end up having far more impact when we're talking to the people in finance And to be able to have a more aligned conversation between finance and accounting, and even have a new startup in Compass Labs that's looking at the HR assessment side. So let's build bridges over there as well. So my goal these days is much broader. It's not just to improve marketing, but it's to take a lot of the stuff that maybe marketers are generally the only ones to appreciate and make it the heart of an enterprise-wide strategy to help us just run our business more effectively through this lens of customer behavior.
So we've got a few moments left, and I want to cover two areas, a little bit different areas, but one that I really want to get your perspective on is that elephant in the room that all of us who are practitioners of market research and insights today have to grapple with, and that's the concerns about data quality. How do you advise leaders as well as your partners about making sure that the data that they're using is clean and trustworthy and really fit for purpose?
So there's several levels to that question. First, it's walk before you run. There are so many companies who are just paralyzed thinking that, oh, we're going to have data problems here, whether it's technical problems collecting, storing, leveraging the data, or legal problems like GDPR. And so they're paralyzed into indecision, saying, why even bother? Why even collect this stuff if we're not going to fully leverage it? I hate that. So, like you said, walk before you run. Let's go out there and maybe let's start small. Before building this, the full CRM system for everybody, let's start with the mobile app or the loyalty program. Let's start small to see what can we collect, what insights can we pull out of it, and then start to grow from there. So I want to see companies dip their toes in the water to see at least what they're capable of before doing some big, giant, multi-million dollar initiative and expecting money to show up moments later. So it's in some sense building the right corporate culture to kind of enable the data collection and the kind of leveraging of it, rather than kind of starting with data per se. And then as we do move further along and we start to then bump into some of those limitations, we think we've squeezed as much insight as possible. There's always ways to go further. And that's where we start to turn less to the data and more to the models. So let's be able to extrapolate. Let's be able to fill in the blank. Let's be able to fuse different data sets together. So that's where the stuff that I do for a living, again, the models really start to shine and add value above and beyond the data. So there's just a natural progression, a trajectory, a maturity cycle for companies to follow. And so much of my work isn't just, hey, here's a model, but here's the steps, the stages that you need to go through in order to be as savvy as possible with it.
And that kind of feeds right into the final question I want to ask as we're just about at the time limit here. There's so many skills, both hard and soft skills, that now become part of insights. I like to joke around that the difference between today's successful insights company and a traditional management consultant is only the cost of the engagement. Without kind of seeding or guiding you, leading you towards that response, what are the skill sets? What's the balance between technical skills and business acumen and storytelling that people in earlier career stages really will need to be focusing on to be successful in this space going forward?
Boy, I've learned the answer to that excellent question the hard way. Because I'm a technical guy. I just like to build these models. But like I said before, I've recognized that having the great model, you need more than that. So I've really grown an appreciation of whether you want a corporate, call it corporate culture or corporate, call it corporate politics, to be able to find ways to win over your partners in other parts of the organization and the folks outside the organization, your investors, your suppliers, just the other firms that you might collaborate with. So being able to tell that story, being able to find metrics that might not matter that much to the marketing folks, but going to matter an awful lot to the supply chain, the talent management, the finance people, and hopefully doing so off of the same data set and off of the same model. So we don't have to invent an entirely different narrative or methodology for these different groups, but to find ways to just slightly reorient what we're doing to make it appealing to these other folks. So learning how to play that game, dance that dance, talk that talk, has been, like you said, a real education for me. And I continue to learn as much about those kinds of soft skills as I do about, you know, here's a better way to do the forecasting. And I think likewise, the education that our students get has to be much more balanced in that same way.
No, it's fascinating to be a part of it, you know, then and now, and to see where it's gone. I thank you so much for being on Insights and Innovators, and I thank you again for continuing to teach me things, you know, even this many years later from the pure academic standpoint. Great to have you on, and great to see you.
Good to talk to you, John. Let's see who's calling. But thanks very much. Really, really good to talk to you.
Thanks for joining the Insights and Innovators podcast from Market Research Institute International. Click subscribe to never miss an episode and visit us at MRII.org for more market research insights.